breakfast. Thanks for coming. You can call me Oma now. It means grandma in Dutch.
Yay!
My daughter's a lawyer in Madison. She had a little boy on July 24th. They're doing great, so I'm thrilled. We're going to have our Chapter 13 trustees in a second. Next month, September and October, we don't have any topics yet. If you want a topic, please suggest one. If you're willing to speak and lead the discussion, please let me know or Anton Nikolai. Otherwise, we just will skip September and October, and we'll be back in November for Supreme Court, and then December for ethics. So we're definitely on for those, but September and October we're not sure about yet. For everybody that was here last month, we got that ethics credit. So thanks again to Ryan and
Nathan Zimmerman
for that great presentation. We did qualify for that ethics credit on that one, so thanks again. For now, we've got Mary Grossman and Rebecca Garcia here. They're our Chapter 13 trustees, and they're going to enlighten us on all the hot topics in Chapter 13.
Okay, I'll get started today, and I'm going to start with funds held by the Chapter 13 trustee at conversion, and it's the third page in of your text. We had a Supreme Court case decided this year in Harris versus Veglen, and it's a post-confirmation case. This case, the court said that, and there had been a split in the circuits, but the court decided that the Chapter 13 trustees' services end immediately upon conversion. It says in the code that the trustee is terminated, and the court took that seriously. And so that's going to apply actually to both pre- and post-confirmation Chapter 13 cases. And what happens then upon conversion is that any money that the trustee is holding immediately or the next time the trustee disperses has to go back to the debtor. Mary Veglen had dispersed money to creditors, and it's interesting, she was holding $5,500, and she sent $1,200 to the debtor's attorney and $4,300 out to creditors. The court only addressed the amount that went back to creditors. They only addressed the $4,300. So she had to get that money back and send it to the debtor. This matters for all of you because of your attorney's fees. Up until this case was decided, we used to send you, if you had a fee application that was approved, under 1326A2, those were 503B fees that we could send to you. And then and my office had been sending the rest of the money out to back to the debtor for a long time. Rebecca, I think Tom and then you were sending the money to creditors.
It was going out to creditors.
If it was post-confirmation. Both pre- and post-confirmation, my office had been sending the money back to the debtors except for any 503B fees that had been approved. This is a big change for Rebecca's office. For me, it's not that big a change, but the fees are what are really important. And the reason I told you about what happened in the Supreme Court case is very important to you, because in Harris's attorney had an assignment of fees. And they don't get into this at all in the Supreme Court case, but there is another case that's come out after that that went back into the, looked at the background on Harris and found that the debtor's attorney had an assignment of the fees. And he filed that assignment along with the notice of conversion. So the debtor never had a problem with the money that went to the attorney. What does that mean for you? If you go and get a fee application approved, and we don't, and then the debtor converts. Right now, I would have to send all of the money back to the debtor. And Judge Kelly, I think you and some of the other judges have taken it off of your order that the money goes back to upon conversion.
Right.
That you've removed that attorney's fee language from the.
Right, but
conversion.
On dismissal, it still can go to the attorney, but it's
yes,
conversion.
Absolutely.
I think we need to make remember, keep that distinction in mind.
It's really important. This only applies to conversions. So anyway, what can you do about it? And I think you can look a little bit to what happened in the background in Harris, what happened to the attorney's fees. There is a case out of New Mexico, and I'll give you the site for it. I only have a Lexis site. It's Beauregard, and it's 2015 Bankruptcy Lexis 2279. It was decided this year. And in that case, the court looked at exactly what we've talked about here. Can the trustee pay 503B fees upon conversion pre-confirmation? The court said no, but the court said, just as we feel here, we want attorneys to be paid. And I know a lot of you don't take money up front. We want you to be paid. And what the court suggested in Beauregard is that the attorneys follow what happened in Harris and get an assignment. And the specific language in the assignment is in the Beauregard case. There is one other case out there right now. It's Ulmer, and it is out of the Western District of Louisiana. The site on that is 2015. Bankruptcy Lexis 2202, and there the court would not pre-authorize any fees, either for conversion or dismissal, but certainly said that the trustee has no authority to pay 503B fees pre-confirmation on a conversion. So you want to look at both of those cases. I know there are cases pending in other courts. In fact, Vieglin, the trustee, she's a trustee in Texas, her court already has cases pending on how the trustee can pay the fees. Talk with your contacts in other districts. I know some of you are members of NACBA. See what you hear from them, how their courts are handling it. There are creative ways to do it. There's the assignment that Harris had. Another option that I've heard, I haven't seen it tested anywhere, and that is alleging a lien on those proceeds. But remember, if you don't get that money up front, and your debtor, or you don't get it from the trustee, and your debtor converts, those fees are going to be discharged. Any uncollected fees are going to be discharged in the Chapter 7. So this is important for you. If anybody wants to try any of these mechanisms for making sure you get your fees, I will probably object to it, not because I don't want you to have your fees, but I want the court to decide and give me an order telling me it's okay to pay you.
And I think the only other thing that I would add to that is you know, think about, you know if a case is going to convert. You're the one that has the control over that, so to an extent. So if you're going to do a conversion, think about these things as that time is coming near. And if you have a lot of money into a case, get that done ahead of time.
Well, and that works only for post-confirmation. Pre-confirmation, the code says that the trustee has to retain funds until confirmation or denial of confirmation. So I'm not going to be able to pay you out of pre-confirmation funds in any case, unless you use a conversion court order.
In a unique case,
we had a unique case recently where the court denied confirmation and it's on appeal, and that was enough to allow me to get an order from Judge Kelly to pay the attorney's fees. Anything else that you can think of on that?
I don't think so. Does anybody have any questions, anything to add?
Okay. Next thing I want to talk about is fee on receipts. And some of you may have heard of this, some of you may not have heard of it. Almost the entire country changed to what we call trustee fee on receipts last October 1st. It was initially required by the U.S. trustee. After everyone changed, they said, well, maybe it's not required. But And what we're going to be, both Rebecca and I are going to be changing to fee on receipts on October 1st. What's really important for all of you to know is there is no change in the fee that we collect. It's just a timing issue when we collect the fee. And we'll go through some examples. The basis for the fee on receipts is that it applies to plan payments. And so I'll be taking my fee when I receive a plan payment. If we later determine for some reason that it's not a plan payment, I'm going to reverse the fee on that, because there's a fair amount of money that I get that really ends up not being a plan payment. So I'll take the fee up front. I think the best example, the easiest example, is the first one that I've given you, and that's if I get insurance money in. Say I get $7,000 of insurance money, we'll assume the fee is at 5%. I'm at 5.2 right now. I'm going down to 4.1. I was at 4.1 most of the year, and I'll average out at 4.3, and I'll drop again to 4.1 on October 1st. So I use 5%. I always use 5% in my calculations, because sometimes I'm at 5 or a little higher. But anyway, let's say that I get $7,000 of insurance proceeds. I'll take my 5%, my $350, when the money comes in. If you file an amended plan asking for that money back so that your client can buy a car, which happens a lot, I will then reverse the $350 fee. So I'm not getting any extra money. It's just the time that I get it. A little bit more complicated example is that if I receive $600 up front, but I only need $400 to pay off the case. That's okay. Okay, so if I only need $400 to pay off the case, I'll take my 5%, $30, when the $600 comes in. Then I'll reverse part of that when I return money to the debtor. So the way you see it right now, under the fee on disbursement, you see the $600 as available on my website. And then when I disperse $380 to creditors, I take my $20 fee and return $200 to your client. It's going to look a little different on my website now. You're going to see that I will have taken the fee off of the $600. So you'll see $570 available. I'll still disperse the same $380 to creditors, and I'll reverse $10 of my fee and return the same $200 to your client. So when you're looking at my website after October 1st, keep in mind that you're seeing something that's a little different than you used to see. As I mentioned, all but one of the districts around the country is already on fee on receipts. The big problem that is causing me is I haven't updated my software in over a year. And so I'm going to have a big crash before long. I have to go to fee on receipts. My software provider does not support anything but fee on receipts anymore.
And right now I would say that my software provider does, but it's not going to be forever. So that day is coming where I'm not going to be able to update my software with other changes that come along, so that's important. And I think just to reiterate what Mary said is, you know, now when you look at both our websites, and everything that Mary said about her website is true for me, what you'll see is after the fee is taken, it's one less calculation that you have to do when you're looking on the website, because the trustee fee has already been accounted for on there.
Talk to some of the attorneys who practice in other districts. I've had some ask me why I haven't changed yet. The Western District changed in October. Some of you practice in more than even outside of Wisconsin. and there they've already changed to fee on receipts, and they're reporting no problems with it. I had initially been concerned about our model plan that says that the trustees shall receive a fee for each disbursement. It doesn't say upon each disbursement. There are quite a few other districts that have identical plan language. They had no problem changing to fee on receipts. So we're going to go ahead and do that on October 1st. Any questions?
Okay. All right. I'm going to skip to the late claims, and this is the Seventh Circuit case. Pajon, I'll pronounce it. If I'm wrong, somebody can tell me that. And this is a case that came out of the Seventh Circuit earlier this year. I think most of you are aware of it, but if you're not, I'll just give you a little bit of a background. The Seventh Circuit went through why, you know, the late claim language, and you know, it gives, you know, that first of all, that a proof of claim is filed and allowed unless objected to. And then that 3002C governs the time for filing proof of claim, and there are very limited exceptions to that. Traditionally, both my office and Mary's office have always objected to claims that are late for priority and general unsecured creditors. We have not objected to late claims for secured creditors. And the Seventh Circuit went through, there is a split among bankruptcy courts on this issue, some courts saying that, you know, that the deadline applies to all creditors, other courts saying that the deadline does not apply to secured creditors. And the Seventh Circuit and Pajon went through and said clearly, they stated very clearly that 3002C applies to any proof of claim, not just secured claims. And the other part of it, we have a trustee handbook that is put out by the UST, and I put a little bit of the language in there, which requires us to object to claims, to late claims, or any proof of claim that's not accurate.
And the code specifically says that one of the bases for objecting to a claim is a claim that's not timely filed. So this goes beyond the rules. It's right in the code.
Yeah. So our handbook requires that we follow the controlling legal authority. So I know since shortly after this decision has come out, both Mary and I have been objecting to late filed secured claims. So that is, and again, this puts something back on you and that you need to watch for, because the creditors after the claims bar date don't have the ability to extend the time to file a proof of claim. They are basically done. However, debtors counsel, U.S. debtors counsel, do have that 30-day window under Rule 3004 to file a proof of claim for the creditor. One of the things that I've begun doing, because I'm, as a trustee, neither, you know, I'm not going to file a claim. The 3004 actually allows the trustee or the debtor to file a proof of claim. As trustees, we don't have enough information to file claims on behalf of those creditors. We just don't have the knowledge that we need. But one of the things that I have started doing, and I don't know that I'm going to continue long term, but right after the law change, after the bar date passes, while you're in that window, if there's a secure claim that hasn't got a hasn't filed a claim, my office is sending out a little form letter that says, hey, you might want to file a proof of claim for X, Y, or Z creditor. So hopefully that's helped. It was designed mostly to get folks who may not be aware that this law, that the decision came out, to make them aware of it and get them to file their proofs of claim. So filing that proof of claim for a secured or any other creditor that you want as debtor's counsel to get paid is really important. But after that 30 days is up, it's going to be really fairly difficult for you to file a proof of claim either. So I think what's really important as a procedure in your office is to, when that case is filed and you know what the bar date is, tickle each file for both, and I would say for both the regular and the government bar date, because maybe there's an IRS claim you want to make sure gets filed for one reason or another, or Department of Workforce Development, or property taxes is another big one. That's a government claim, could be the government bar date. So you need to, I think, tickle both of them, go back, review your file, and file appropriate proofs of claim for those creditors. There is, I think, a limited ability to, for you, maybe, and maybe it's limited to this time period. I know I've seen one motion, and there might be others out there. Due to the timing of when this case came down and what the traditional stance was, I have seen a couple motions by debtors' counsel to say, I would like to extend the 3004 deadline under Rule 9006, which is allowed, and my excusable neglect for doing that is because it was this date passed before this Seventh Circuit case came out. I think that works in the limited term. You can extend 3004 under 9006 for excusable neglect, but as this time passes and the cases become more common, I don't think, oh, I just missed the deadline is probably enough to do that. So it may be in a certain particular fact situation work for you. And for a limited amount of time, it may work for you. But I think it's really very important to review all those cases.
Rebecca, what happens if there's no proof of claim filed? I mean, if you just say in your plan that the plan controls, is that going to be good enough, or do you have to have the claim in order to pay it?
We have to have the claim in order to pay it.
Among other things, we have to know who and where to send the money. I have to have a proof of claim. It has a box on it that says where payments should go.
So yeah, you definitely want to. A proof of claim has to be filed, and I think among other things, I think it's also right in our plan document that says you must file a proof of claim to be paid.
Remember that secured debt is not gone, and if there's no claim filed, you can still deal with that outside of the plan too.
If it's something that's completely missed. It might be a plan that you modified. Going back to you filing a proof of claim, one of the Rule 3001, which governs filing proof of claims, asks for certain attachments, and that's going to start to get more complicated if the, you know, as the rules change, maybe in December of 2016. But do file attachments, even if you're the one filing a proof of claim. And we realize that you're not going to have every piece of documents. You're not going to know exactly how far behind, you know, the debtor was. But give us what you have. You know, you can get the recorded mortgage. You probably do that all the time anyway. You may have the, your debtor may have the note. Even if you have the most recent statement, so we have some idea that we're sending the money to the right place, because I know, you know, part of what's going to happen, I can guarantee it, is you're going to do your best job. You're going to file a proof of claim for the creditor. We're going to send the money out to that creditor, and the creditor's going to send it back to us and say, oh, we don't know what this is. So,
that's,
you know,
exactly what's going to happen.
Well, don't you think once the debtor files a proof of claim, now the creditor will come in and amend it?
We would hope so, but
why wouldn't they, Jay?
I can't tell you how many claims are never filed.
Yeah, there's
a huge number are never filed.
Yeah. So yeah. Hopefully, the creditor would come in and amend your proof of claim. Or, you know, if you've been working, maybe you've been working with somebody on a mortgage mediation and you notice that claim isn't filed, I'm sure Jay would be happy to assist you, you know, if his deadline is passed under 3002, but you're still on the 3004, if you have a contact at the creditor, say to them, get me all the stuff, I'll file the proof, you know, and then you're just the one who actually files the proof of claim. So that would be great if that could happen. So. But yeah, do the best you can to attach something. Chris in the back has a question.
Make sure it's redacted.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
If you didn't hear that, make sure the claim is redacted.
But please make sure you've got at least enough of the account number on the proof of claim so that when that creditor gets the money, they have some idea where it goes.
Yeah. The payments the creditors get from my office, and I think Mary's the same, to include the case number and the last four digits of the debtor's account number. And we do get calls, you know, okay, I'm not sure, you know, this is Mary Jones, and I've got 4 Mary Joneses across the country. So the more information you can provide, the better. The other one I wanted to mention involves a recent case that Judge Helfinger decided. That's watching out for adversary proceedings and the claims that result from them. Oftentimes, you file your adversary to strip the second mortgage. And in the adversary, often in stipulations, it will state the debtor, the creditor has X amount of time to file a general unsecured claim. But oftentimes you don't arrive at those stipulations until all the bar dates are passed. And what Judge Helfinger decided in the case that I cited in the materials was that doing the stipulation was not a judgment, and it didn't fit within the 3002C3 exception. So again, you're going to want to file that proof of claim. And it's oftentimes confusing for my staff when they have a the creditor files a timely secured proof of claim, the adversary gets filed, and it doesn't say treat that timely filed secured proof of claim as unsecured. It says the debtor has so many days to file an unsecured claim. Well, what do we do with that then? So that can be a little confusing. So
wouldn't the answer be stipulate to amend the secured claim and make it an unsecured claim? That should be fine.
That should absolutely.
If there's no claim on file, though, the bar date is run, and now you're going to try to stipulate that they can file a late unsecured claim, that's where I think his problem was.
Right, and then my question becomes, why would you stipulate if it's past the bar date and you haven't filed a claim? In that case, you'd probably want to allow for a default judgment so that you'd have the 30 days after judgment to file the claim.
And that's from the creditor's perspective, you probably wouldn't want to stipulate. You'd want to allow time for that default judgment to pass. Dave?
Our creditors, our clients don't like default judgments.
Okay.
They always want to stipulate. We don't know why. The terms of the stipulations are almost identical to the term of any judgment. They just don't want default judgments.
Okay.
Can you repeat that for the...
Jay Pittner had 2 points. First, he said his clients really do not want default judgments, even if the terms are going to end up being identical to the stipulation. But, Jay, that's something your clients will have to deal with if they haven't filed a claim. And then the other, Jay's other point was that very often his office already knows the amount of the arrearage, and they're just waiting for approval to file the claim. So if you're in the 30 days after the bar date, you're going to be filing on behalf of your client, ask Jay for the arrearage amount. He said he'd be willing to give you that.
All right. That's late filed claims. I think, you know, the takeaway is you have to be even more diligent than many of you already are about reviewing the claims and reviewing the docket right after the claims bar is passed, and make sure that you get those claims filed. You know, your debtors are definitely not going to want to have filed a bankruptcy to save their house and then find out 3-4 years down the road that the mortgage never got paid because no claim was filed.
You know, along those same lines, I have stopped objecting to confirmation when a secured claim comes in and it's not provided for in the plan. And you'd be surprised how often that happens. Sometimes your debtor has co-signed on a car that they forgot to tell you about, things like that. And my office just sends a letter out to the creditor, and I'm sure we copy you and your client on it, saying this claim was not provided for in the plan, and therefore we're not going to be paying on it. So if you've been seeing those, that's what's going on. But Judge Helfinger told us that was not grounds for objecting to confirmation.
And that's that thing that when you get that letter, you can't amend your plan to provide for that particular claim. It's just telling you it's not in your plan now, and what you do about that is really up to you.
Yeah.
So, and again, Mary, I just reiterate the point that Mary made before. The secured, if it's truly a secured claim, it's going to survive the discharge. So you probably do want to do something about it. So, and we have just a couple other kind of smaller. Those were the three big topics we wanted to hit on today. But there are a couple other smaller items of interest that we wanted to point out. One is trustee plan modifications. It's something that in the years that I was at Mary's office and now up in Oshkosh, hasn't been traditionally done a lot by the trustee, but it's something that you're going to start to see more, I think, from both of our offices. Probably Mary's already now, and
I think we're ready to go. We're ready to start testing it.
Yeah, and mine is probably going to be a little bit down the road, but where this is coming from is oftentimes you'll file a plan and you'll say, I'm going to pay a 5% dividend to the unsecured creditors. And you provide for a car and mortgage arrearage and whatever else, maybe some priority debt. And somewhere along the line, maybe the mortgage gets relief from stay, maybe if there's an IRS claim and the IRS offsets, so they take some money out of their proof of claim. And then there's, and then we're at a point in the plan where, okay, we've got X amount of dollars coming in for X number of months. We've paid the secured, we've paid the priority debt, we've paid the 5% to unsecureds, but the plan is a 60-month plan, and we still have 2 years left. One of the things previously it was maybe a letter that went out. Now we're going to modify the plan to give you notice and the creditors notice that, no, it's not going to be 5% anymore. Now we can, the plan will run 60 months and we're going to be able to pay 15% to the general unsecured creditors instead of 5.
I just want that in the confirmation order. We've been increasing the percentage as money's available for years, so it's not a change in what we would otherwise be paying. It's just that I want it in a confirmation order now
to have that. And along those lines, and it comes down to the number two. I was going to go back and put the language in here, and I didn't, but we can certainly provide that. A lot of times when you start out, you have a 60-month plan for, and this is for an under-median debtor, because obviously an over-median debtor must be in a plan for 60 months. But for that under-median income debtor, if you just say 60 months and 5%, which is more important? It becomes, okay, well, that's why we're going to modify the plan to say, okay, we're going to let this go 60 months. And unless you have some language, and usually we see it in the special provisions, and it says something to the effect of, if everybody is able to be paid, secured, priority, and unsecured up to whatever percent, the plan shall end.
And we've gone 36 months.
Yes, and we've gone 36 months, the minimum, the plan shall otherwise end. And we're happy to see that language. We're happy to see you use that language. I don't think we want to punish under-median debtors and make them stay in a plan for 60 months just to pay X amount to unsecured creditors.
Right. But I used to shorten the plan. Let's say you proposed a 60-month plan and your client met all the requirements of the plan at 40 months. I used to close out the case. I stopped doing that a while ago. Because creditors have been notified that that's a 60-month plan, and I don't think that that's the right thing to do, and I don't think Tom ever did that.
No, this is in the Oshkosh office, and I have not changed it. If you file a 60-month plan, you're in for 60 months unless there's a modification filed.
Right, and so quite a while ago I stopped cutting off the plan early and making it run 60 months if you proposed it at 60 months. If you want to shorten it, that's fine, but you have to amend the plan to shorten it.
No.
All I'm going to be doing is amending the plan to increase the percentage. I'm not asking your client to pay more. It's what they had already scheduled out to pay. I just want the percentage in a confirmation order. But I would much prefer to have that language that allows me to shorten the plan and have that right up front, so that creditors get notice of it in the original plan, that there's a possibility that that plan will not run the full 60 months. And again, it's really only for below median income debtors. I'll still file the amended plan for above median income debtors, but you don't have the ability to shorten the plan.
And if any of you see that I filed an amended plan to increase the percentage for a below median income debtor so that the creditors will get a certain amount over 60 months and you don't like that, please file, you can object to my amended plan, but better is just file your own amended plan shortening the term.
And Mary, how do you think, do you want somebody to object to yours and file their own as a procedural matter, or if they file their own, will you withdraw yours?
If they file their own and it's okay with me, I'll withdraw mine.
So, okay. So that's trustee plan modifications. Just like you, we do have to notice all creditors, so it's
I wouldn't do it if I had to notice all creditors. I'm asking, I'm also filing with it. It's all set up in one form. A motion to limit notice because no one is adversely affected.
And that's what you have to do. I mentioned that because I see a lot, I've seen since I've been in Oshkosh, a lot of people not notice creditors, and it's not like they're not noticing some of them. There's just a plan filed with no notice and it's post-confirmation. So it's just my reminder, you know, if it's post-confirmation, the bankruptcy rule 3015 says you notice all creditors. However, our judges, And I think the rule itself, you know, allows the court to order otherwise. And so how Mary's doing it is perfectly fine with me, too. You just have to, you know, file that. It's usually an ex parte motion to limit the notice and an order. So we go from there. Other items of interest, I want to talk about e-pay and electronic payments a little bit. ePay is something that Tom started before I got there, and I've continued it, and I think Mary has plans to go there at some point. But how, just so the debtors and so you know when you're talking to your debtors how it works, is ePay is through my website, so they can't go to their bank, you know, Harris or U.S. Bank and do bill pay because that is just a personal check. And that gets rejected just like a personal check if you're doing bill pay through your own bank. The ePay system that's set up through my website and goes through the bank that we use does, you know, it comes in, the debtor signs up for an account, they log in, and they make a payment. There are some facets of it that debtors sometimes don't like. There is a $2 fee. The $2 fee is usually less than they'd pay for any money order. Plus, they save the time of going to get a money order and postage and that hassle. So, yes, there is a fee for it. That just covers the cost that the bank charges me for the ePay payments. They go on, they sign up for the ePay payments, and one of the other points of it, I've had several debtors say, oh, can I schedule it so the fifth of every month this money comes out? We don't allow that. We don't allow it for a couple reasons. The big one is if somebody sets up 5 years of payments of $500 on the fifth of each month, what happens in year three when they lose their job and then suddenly those checks start bouncing?
I'm going to do the same thing as Rebecca with respect to that. They're going to have to do the push from their account to my bank each time. They'll have to log on and do it each time.
Yeah, and it also, I think it also reminds the debtors that they have this obligation, makes them a little bit responsible for, you know, at least logging in and making sure that payment gets made each month. There are still some NSFs that come through ePay, and so that's something that we deal with. One of the big ways, and we have it, you know, on the disclaimer that they authorize, if they have one bounce check, they're cut off from ePay and they can't do it anymore. So far that's worked pretty good as a deterrent. It's difficult when we have money going into a trust account to have bounced checks when I'm sending it out to creditors. That's the other point I'd like to bring up about it. When they make those payments via ePay, because the debtor does have the ability to go to their bank and put a stop payment on that, because of the ability, usually we know in a day or two if the check bounces, but because they do have the ability to stop that payment, we do hold that money for 30 days before we send it out to creditors to make sure it's good funds. So if somebody sends a payment on the 10th of the month, and on the 20th of the month I do my disbursement to the creditors, that money's not going out to those creditors until the fall, you know, it'd be, now we're in August, so that money wouldn't go out to creditors until September. So there is a little bit of a delay on the trustees' end for that.
And I'm going to do the same 30-day delay. I already do a 10-day delay on money orders and cashier's checks, and you'd be surprised, it really does affect your cash flow. When I switched over to 10-day holds on the cashier's checks and money orders, I had some complaints about the debtor's attorney's fees being too low, and it was because of the delay.
Yeah. So,
do you hold cashier's checks and money orders?
I think for 15 days.
15?
Yeah. 15 days. So, yeah.
But what about employer payments? These are all debtor direct.
These are all debtor direct. Cashier's checks and money orders.
Isn't that the best way, is employer payments, or no? What do you think?
Oh, I would love them. I'd love to have everybody have an
employer payment. Yeah.
But a lot of people don't have the ability. Especially, we're seeing a lot more elderly than we used to see, and their source of funds is Social Security. So they may be good candidates for the e-pay. But the other thing I see, and I see it a lot more in Milwaukee than in Racine and Kenosha, is I have a lot of debtors without bank accounts.
Yeah.
So that is just not going to be an option for them. And I believe some of the attorneys actually use the e-pay. I believe that they'll take the money in, put it in their trust account, and then they'll do the e-pay, especially if their client is on a doomsday and is going to be late with a payment.
Do that. Related to the employer payments, one other thing that I'm in the process of setting up now, we get, and you may get, I don't think you would get it as much as we do, but the employers call us and say, I have 5 employees that are in bankruptcy and you're the trustee and I don't want to send a physical check. Can I do electronic payments? The only way I had the ability to do that was through e-pay, and then the employers had to pay the $2 fee and they didn't want to do that. But now we're working on having the ability again through our bank to have the employers submit or push funds to us for their employees electronically. I'm hoping to have that up and running early September so that the employees, you know, the employers know that they can just do an electronic payment as well. I think that'll be more convenient for them. You know, anything we can do to help debtors make payments, I think, is a good thing. And one of the things that at some point we're testing with ADP. ADP is the, you know, or pay. ADP is a big check, but it'll be paychecks and some of those check writing services that we'll start with. But as we get other larger local employers who want to participate, that'll be available as well.
And I'll be adopting that also. And the other thing it does is it actually saves money. E-pay saves money, and so does having the employer do the deposit, because when the money is sent electronically, it has a case number associated with it. Right now, I pay for every single item to have it key punched and have the payment associated with a case number. But when it's sent electronically, it's sent with the case number.
Right.
And so that will save money on the entering of receipts also.
Yeah. And Mary's office pays for the bank to do that. I have employees that's their job, to data punch the payments and put them in the system, and that those two, because it will already have the case number associated, will help make our offices more efficient. Maybe the trustee fee goes down. So
while we're talking about payments, I'll just throw in a reminder that if your debtor is paying, your debtor client is paying in installments, you're expected to pay those fees through pay.gov. You'd be amazed at how many we issue the installment order. We're happy to do it. The code allows for it. Don't be shy about asking in the right situation. But then we get a letter from the debtor saying, I'm not going to be able to make my fee payment that's due on August 11th. Can I have until August 15th? Well, first of all, debtor, you've got a lawyer who's supposed to be making motions if you want something from the court. And second of all, we shouldn't be looking for your payment being walked down to the courthouse. This should be coming to pay.gov through the attorney. It's just a reminder, that's how it should be done. And if you have such a client, by doing it this way, you can monitor and make sure because we don't like to dismiss cases for failing to pay the filing fee, but we have to do it. It's not fair to the trustees that they do all the work of working up the case, and now the debtor's case is getting dismissed for failing to pay the filing fee. If it's a represented debtor, you should be on top of it and going, hey, wait a minute, I haven't gotten the money, or however you've worked it out with your client, this case is going to get dismissed. Don't, please tell the debtors, don't write us letters, don't come down to the courthouse with your money. You should be paying that fee through pay.gov, and if the debtor needs more time, ask for more time, file a simple motion, we're happy to extend it, but it, that's the way that should be done, not these desperate letters from these folks who say, you know, I just need 3 more days. By the time I issue the order, the 3 days is over, now what? So, just a general reminder on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Another thing about electronic payments, I pay almost all attorneys electronically now. If you're not on ACH payment and you would like to be, it's very easy, just get in touch with my office. We'll send you the information. I have, I think, 3 creditors that I am paying electronically. I'm real leery about paying creditors electronically because when I pay with a paper check, I can look to the claim and I've got an address where I am supposed to send the money. I'm very nervous if I get something from a creditor, somebody at the creditor's office saying, hey, instead of that address on the claim, send it to this bank account. And so I'm struggling with that, and there are other trustees around the country that are struggling with that too. And that's why I'm not pushing for paying creditors electronically until there's some system in place that will protect me when I send the money to a bank account that's not listed on the proof of claim.
Yeah, and I'll say that before I started in Oshkosh, there, the electronic payment to creditors was set up, so we are doing many more creditors than Mary's doing, but it's something that I'm monitoring pretty carefully. I'm not really encouraging any new creditors to do it, but you know, I'm trying to do things the best way I can, such as if I get a request for it, I'll call back and ask to talk to somebody different at the creditor and say, hey, because your secretary sent me this, is this the right bank account? Because the last thing that I obviously want to do is send the money, which is exactly what Mary's concerned about, send the money to a bank account, and it's not the bank account for ABC Bank. It's Mary Smith, who's the secretary at ABC Bank, you know.
And I had a bad situation with a creditor that kind of made me stop and think about what I was doing with the ACH. I had the CEO of a very small credit union get in touch with me and say, hey, send this money to this account at the credit union. And who do I verify with then to be sure that it's correct? So I found the name of the chairman of the credit union, sent him an email, and I've never heard back from anybody. So I went, ooh, I think I better not do that.
Yeah. So don't, you know, I think to extent, but Mary's right, I do pay, because debtors counsel, you guys don't file proofs of claim, so you can tell me to send it electronically.
Exactly.
And I'm happy to do that as well. So I think that helps. I want to talk a little bit about NDC. For those of you who don't know, NDC is the National Data Center. And one of the things, you know, that I realized going to Oshkosh and knew before is everybody says, Mary's website is so much easier to read than yours. It's so much easier to get through. I'm not changing websites, so I'll just tell you all that right now.
And mine is still there, too.
But NDC is a national. It's really set up for the benefit of a lot of creditors, but almost every trustee in across the whole United States sends data to NDC, and then debtors and debtors counsel can look at all that information. And it's the same information that's on Mary and my website, you know, payments, disbursements, who's going out, and it's and the reason, and I'd like to encourage for sure all of your debtors. Number one, you only have one website to get out. They go to ndca.org. There's a really pretty easy way to sign up for it. I've been trying to remember to bring the NDC flyers to the 341 meetings and hand them out. But they can look up all their information that way. And if you are somebody who practices, for both of us, I mean, anybody who's in Milwaukee is going to get my cases sometimes, or Madison, I know Mark Herring's information's on the NDC, or if you practice in Illinois, you also only have to go to one website to get information about a particular debtor. The creditor ability to use the NDC is mostly so that Wells Fargo, when they want to know, you know, what payments were made in X particular case, they their employees have one website to go to too. So it's uniform, and how it's paid for is the creditors actually pay for the service, but it's free for debtors and debtors' counsel.
And it is available for small creditors also. There's a fee structure depending on the size of the creditor. So if there are any smaller creditors out there that you know of that want to use it, it can be helpful for them.
So it also has some protections in place that are helpful as far as the data sensitivity. They're pretty careful about what they allow out.
And I haven't been doing it yet. I'll probably start. We have the ability to post things by trustees. So if your clients have a question, and I have to get up and running first, but if they have a question about, are there 341s today? You know, we had 6 inches of snow. Are we still going to have the 341s? I will have the ability to post messages on the NDC.
So, and that is also a nice feature. One thing, and I looked up to see how long ago it was, Mary and I, when I was in her office back in 2010, did a nuts and bolts, mostly geared towards staff, as far as schedule preparation, plan preparation, and we are considering offering it again soon. We wouldn't charge you. We also wouldn't do a CLE credit for it, because what we're really looking at is literally the nuts and bolts. What do you put on this line? How do you want that to coordinate? Check, you know, getting us the documents, the best ways to do that. And again, it's something we really want geared toward. Attorneys are certainly welcome. I don't want to discourage that, but it's really geared toward the folks in your office who prepare the petition and schedules, so that it just helps us, because it makes it easier for us to look at if they're done right.
And we saw a real increase in quality after the nuts and bolts class, and staff would call us about specific questions and things. It worked really well, but you know, it was 5 years ago, and you've had a lot of staff turnover in that time. Mm-hmm. So we don't mind. We'd be willing to do that again.
Yeah. So definitely if you're interested, let us know, and I'm sure we'll work out a time. I think it would probably work better for both of us if it's more in the winter, when things tend to slow down a little bit for us. I think we did it last time in February, so I would...
Yeah, that's our slowest month.
That's our slow time, so that's probably when we'd want to do it. The last thing I just want to mention, too, so everybody starts thinking about it, and I noticed on the listserv just yesterday, somebody said, oh, they got the Dear John letter from Easy Filing, because Easy Filing isn't going to update to all the new forms. I'm helping Dayton Hansen and the biker section again with the annual update programming, so we are going to talk about this a little bit in detail, and I put the dates of that on there. But as you know, the past couple of years we got new I and J forms, we got a new statement of or a new B22C form. This December 1st, we are going to get a new petition. Schedules A through J, or A through H, and the Statement of Financial Affairs, and all, basically any other form that a debtor would fill out that hasn't been updated is being updated. The changes are pretty extensive, and so we are going to spend some time, but just know that, and know that you know, we are pretty particular. When you file that case on December 2nd, you better be using the new forms, or you're going to have to go amend them to make use of the new forms. There's also a pretty new proof of claim. I'll thank Jay Pittner publicly in advance, because he's going to talk to us about the new proof of claim form in November at the annual update too.
And please update your software, please. We have a lot of problems with people using old forms, especially right after a change.
And the other thing is, you might not know it, but I have to report amounts for exemptions, and I have quite a few people who have never updated their software, so I have to have somebody actually physically go through and add up all the exemptions. You're supposed to be totaling those on the forms now, but we have to add up your exemptions so that we can put them, I think it's on the
final report. Yeah, it's on the final report. So updating your software helps us too, and it helps you, and it's for creditors. So I think that's all we have.
Can I just tell them one other thing?
Yeah.
I don't think people understand where money goes. They see their individual cases, and they don't always know where all the money goes. So I thought that might be interesting that, and this has been consistent pretty much over my 10 years, is that about 30% of my money goes to non-mortgage creditors, secured creditors, and about 30% to unsecured creditors. Very consistently, about 13% goes to attorneys and 13% to mortgage creditors. And then the rest is priority fees, things like that.
Interesting. Well, thanks very much, Mary and Rebecca. September and October. Thanks so much for coming. It was great information.